For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, let's pray. Jesus, teach us. We truly believe that you're more interested in teaching us than we are in learning. And we recognize that we are slow to learn these things. And you are patient with us. You continue to tell us the same stuff over and over again, and we pretend we know it, and you keep telling us until we begin to do it. So, Father, help us turn knowledge here into wisdom, and open your word to us in a way, Father, that it will produce that kind of wisdom. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, you can kind of, the handout, we'll get to that kind of in the second half there, so you don't need to spend a lot of time here. If you don't get anything else, I want you to understand this single verse here. Two verses. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 1 and 2. It says, let love of the brethren continue. The word there, actually, it's two words in the Greek. Philadelphia, minos. Okay, so that means philia or philos, the root word, would mean love. Delphia, brotherhood. So brotherly love. Let that continue. The word minos just means more, 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 more. Keep doing that. You're doing good on that. Keep doing that. So let the love of the brethren continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. The Greek word there, which is that stunning, exciting title I call this, philoxenia, is also made up of two parts. Philos, like the first word, love or friendship, affection, and xenos, which means what? Stranger, outsider. So they're saying, look, there's two kinds of love. There's this kind of friendship you have for your inside group, and I'm going to suggest to you that we all come, even in our heart, in our fallen state, we come hardwired with this love of the brethren, people like us. It's just deep-seated in human beings. Somebody like me, somebody agrees with me, love that person. I'm into them. But the second kind is what I want to talk about. This is the kind of love that Jesus translates when a person becomes his follower's disciple. Love for the outsider, love for the enemy, as Jesus called it. This is not natural. This is a work of the Holy Spirit. We have to be taught. We have to learn this. Oh, okay, so it's not love the people who are like me. I got to learn how to love and show hospitality to the outsider, the foreigner, the stranger there. And then this last little phrase, very, very interesting phrase. We'll talk a little bit about probably where it came from. For by this, some have entertained angels without knowing it. It's kind of a spooky phrase there. In fact, when I first became a Christian, the goofy guy that was involved in helping me figure out who Jesus was, he took us on a trip. I'm from Kansas City, so a bunch of high school guys, just brand new Christians, and I didn't know anything about the Bible at all. We're driving to St. Louis in a van, and he reads this verse to us. And then he sees this guy off hitchhiking on the side of the highway. And he's like, this could be it, guys. He pulls over, opens the door. The guy gets in. And we're in high school. We're like, whoa. We just picked up an angel, man. This is incredible. Only to find out by the time we got to St. Louis, it was a buddy of his. He said, hey, I'm going to pick you up. Stand out by the deal there. I'm going to freak these guys out. So at least in that context, probably wasn't an angel, even though I don't know. But the context here is this idea, actually taken from Genesis chapter 19. Abraham and Lot begin to show hospitality to outsiders. And at the end of the day, they find out, oh, these are not strangers at all. These are angelic beings who've come to test us. Anybody remember the show a handful of years ago, Touched by an Angel? Yeah. Okay. Here's the problem. I'm not picking on the show. It's not biblical. See, God does not send angels to go help the outsider and the stranger. He sends us. He sends his children. And the strangers and outsiders are sometimes those angelic beings finding out if we've got this concept of philoxenia or not. Probably should have called the show Tested by an Angel. It really wasn't about angels doing the work. The Bible says that we're supposed to show this hospitality to the outsider, and sometimes It's literally like a test. Remember Jesus in Matthew 25, he tells the parable of the sheep and the goats. And what's the punchline? As much as you've done it to the least of them, you've done it to me. I'm hiding in the outsider, the stranger, the broken, the beat up. I'm testing you here in this. So this whole concept I want to talk about, and we're going to start out kind of theoretical, and then we're going to move to practical. How do you begin to do this, actually, in your house church and the ministry context you're in? But initially, I want to talk about the basic concept. There's a great story about Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell was a Puritan leader in Great Britain in the 17th century. So he was the guy in charge of executing corporal discipline, executing prisoners. So he had taken a young man who was about 2 weeks away from his wedding, convicted him of a crime he actually committed, and he convicted him. Normal policy at that time, 17th century England, was you were to be executed at the ringing of the curfew bell, the evening curfew. And the purpose of that was so we won't get a bunch of people coming around and gawking while we execute this guy. They got to be home, curfew. Well, in London, in the Tower, the curfew bell, very prominent, could be heard almost still all over London. Cromwell got accosted outside by the woman who was engaged to be married to that young man. Now, we know this because Cromwell tells this story historically. He tells us what happened. He said she begged and pleaded. I know he made a mistake, but we're going to be married in a couple of weeks. Please, please, what can we do to get around this? And Cromwell was just hardcore. He's like, that's the law. That's what the law says. He's going to be executed at curfew. He leaves, and here's the rest of the story Cromwell tells us later. Later that afternoon, the bell doesn't ring for curfew. So Cromwell walks up the hill to find why is this happening? Well, at that time, the sexton, who was in charge of ringing the bells during the day, was an elderly man, almost completely hard of hearing. This young gal knew this, so right before curfew time, she climbs the tower, she gets inside the gigantic bell there and wraps her body around the clapper, knowing that he'll ring the bell and all you'll hear is thud. Cromwell doesn't know anything about this. He's just going up the hill to go, why hasn't curfew been rung? Halfway up the hill, he says he encountered that young woman beaten and bloodied, bruised all over, and he immediately knew what had happened, that she had been willing to wrap herself around the clapper, knowing the guy was so deaf, he wouldn't even know what had happened there. So he said, okay, I'm going to make an exception here. No curfew tonight. And for about 100 years, England had a certain day of the month because Cromwell made a law that said on this day every month, we don't have curfew because of this one individual girl and her sacrifice. Well, we love stories like this, right? Wow, that's like true love. This is like the kind of love that Jesus, the self-sacrificing love. We love stories about love, particularly if it's the Philadelphia kind. But the truth is, deep-seated in our brokenness, people do not know how to do philoxenia. It's just not natural for us. We don't know how to love the outsider. Martin Marty at the University of Chicago talks about the sociological principle called the bigotry brotherhood paradox. And there's a whole lot of PhD guys who've written about this principle, the bigotry brotherhood paradox. And basically what it means is the tighter a group is, the more prone they are to xenophobia, fear of the outsider. So the very positive thing that goes on, this is the implications, particularly in the context of a house church environment where we're trying to up the Philadelphia. What we're told is in our natural brokenness, it causes us to lower the philoxenia. Here's how Marty puts it. He goes, the meaning is very simple of this principle. The more intense our in-group morale is, the thicker our walls become. In other words, the more we like us, the more we detest them. This is natural. And part of what I want to talk about is, as you're developing leaders in the context of your ministry, this you're going to have to teach. You're going to have to train people. You've got to disciple people to do this. It will not come naturally. It's just not part of how we're wired. We are by nature xenophobes. We fear the outsider. We come up with all kinds of reasons why they're jacked up. The insider, on the other hand, we have the opposite. We are, the term sociologists use, ethnocentric. We think that people like us are amazing in general. We tend to view them in a different light. So here's a couple examples of that. A few years ago, the film The Passion came out. So all of us were like, Mel Gibson. Oh, man, Mel Gibson. He's like the coolest guy in the world. He's incredible. And then a couple of years later, he has his Nazi, anti-Semitic, drunken rant. And you go, uh-oh. I don't know where to file this now. Because my ethnocentrism caused me to go, love the Mel Gibson. Look what he's doing. An accurate film about Jesus' Passion Week. And then he does something that betrays a follower of Christ, and we go, okay, now I'm confused. Same thing is with athletes, whether it's Tim Tebow when you find out he's a Christian, or the greatest pitcher in baseball today, Clayton Kershaw, comes out as a follower of Jesus. I was like, I hate the Dodgers. Now it's like, love the Dodgers. Clayton Kershaw, he's my boy there. I ran into this in a very ugly way personally, confronted with my own ethnocentrism. Probably about 15 years ago, I was part of the church I was leading at the time, was part of a Presbyterian denomination, Evangelical Presbyterian. They had their national meeting, their General Assembly in Denver, Colorado. I'm from Kansas City. Here's all you need to know. We hate Denver. We hate them passionately. And even more, this little older for some of you, we hate more than anything else the face of John Elway, quarterback for Denver. So he is normally referred to in talk radio in Kansas City as Horseface. Okay, and they don't call him the Broncos, they call him the Donkeys. So this is this natural ethnocentrism. Xenophobia says he's not one of us. So I show up at this national conference and a friend of mine says, hey, I got this deal tomorrow I'm going to, this pastor's deal. You got to come to this. You're going to be blown away by the speaker. I go, who? He goes, no, you're just going to be blown away. You just got to come. So I show up the next morning. Guess who is giving their testimony about being a disciple of Jesus? John Elway. And I'm sitting there the whole time going, hate this guy. Hate this guy. I should love this guy. Isn't this amazing what he's sharing? I'm confronted with my own xenophobia. It's just not natural for us to love the outsider. That's why in our culture, everyone says, oh, yeah, I'm into Jesus, all about love. It's like, no, actually, our culture is really into Philadelphia. We're not into this. Love of our enemies. They deserve our hatred, our scorn there. This is just a natural thing. Great, great poem here I ran across a few years ago by Glenn Ross. Here's how he puts it. In heaven, the chefs are French, the police are English, the lovers are Italian, the mechanics are Germans, and the whole place is run by the Swiss. In hell, the chefs are English, the police are German, the lovers are Swiss, the mechanics are Frenchmen, and the whole place is run by the Italians. This is what we mean by stereotyping. We have this sense of, you're an outsider. You're not one of us. It's one of the primary things that Jesus ran into among the Jews of his day. This bigotry brotherhood paradox that the Pharisees had concerning outsiders, Gentiles, Samaritans, tax collectors, prostitutes. Jesus blows these away. He spends so much of the New Testament violating that bigotry brotherhood paradox, confusing the crud out of the religious leaders. Go, wait, we thought you were one of us. You're supposed to hate Samaritans. You're supposed to look down on women. A Jewish prayer in the first century, rabbinic prayer, was, God, thank you that you have not made me a dog or a woman. So when Jesus meets with the Samaritan woman at the well, they're like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? She's Samaritan. We hate those guys. She's a woman. We're not supposed to be alone, particularly talking about God with a woman. And she's an outsider. She's a foreigner. Why are you doing this? A known sinner. Jesus makes a point. Same thing. He goes to one of the Pharisees, a guy named Simon. to his house for dinner. And as they're reclining at table, it says that a local prostitute busts in, takes her vial of perfume, very valuable vial, pours it over Jesus' feet, begins weeping over his feet and wiping with his hair. You know what Simon says? If you were really from God, you'd know what kind of person this is, and you would not allow her to do this. She's not one of us. And so Jesus goes out of his way to blow away Simon's bigotry brotherhood paradox. He's like, you're a xenophobe, dude, and we got to fix that. Okay, so let me show another passage here. James, the brother of Jesus, as he becomes one of his half-brother's followers, he puts it this way. He talks about this problem in the early church. And by the way, this goes on for a couple hundred years in the early church. Church really struggled with this. Even after Jews and Gentiles got semi-reconciled, the next problem was, in the early church, they had people who would, they called them labelli, which meant these are people who had a copy of the scriptures, but during the persecutions, they surrendered it to save their tail. So the big controversy in the early church is, after the persecutions end, they're going, I'm not going to listen to that guy teach because he surrendered the scriptures under persecution and I lost both my children and one of my legs. I'm not going to sit here and he's not going to be my leader. So the early church is going, uh-oh, we got a problem. How do we reconcile this insider-outsider issue here? Here's how James puts it. My brothers and sisters, how can you claim to have faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ if you favor some people over others? For example, suppose someone comes into your meeting dressed in fancy clothes and expensive jewelry, and another comes in who is poor and dressed in dirty clothes. If you give special attention and a good seat to the rich person, but you say to the poor one, you can stand over there, sit on the floor. See, sit on the floor, people. Well, doesn't this discrimination show that your judgments are guided by evil motives? If you favor some people over others, you are committing a sin. You are guilty of breaking the law. Law of Jesus. Love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. James is going, guys, I know you understand Philadelphia, but this tells me you don't get philoxenia yet. You don't know how to befriend the outsider and the stranger. You're not quite getting that concept. So again, principle from Hebrews, very simple. Philadelphia, love for one another, great, keep doing it, more. But do not neglect to show philoxenia. Because God actually shows up and tests you in this. You believe that? You believe Jesus shows up sometimes in your house church just to see if there's philoxenia going on there? It's like, yeah, let's go find out if they know how to love the outsider here. Let's go find out if they figure this out. I believe, over the years, I believe that in ministry, this is the secret sauce. This is the thing that if people learn this, a ministry, a house church, a church, they become dynamically powerful. God can use them in a great way if they get this principle. What happens here is so often ministries decide, well, we're going to skip over that. We're going to assume everybody gets how to do love. And we'll teach apologetics. Now, I'm not here downing apologetics. I'm just saying, out of order, it will not have the correct results. It just won't. You can know a lot. I know a lot of professors who know a lot of knowledge and information, but they are not fruitful in ministry, often because they never learned the basic principle of ministry, and that is how to love the outsider. I'm going to use the phrase that philoxenia is the grammar of ministry. Okay, let me explain that. Trivium is a word. Anybody here familiar or study? Anybody education? So have you gone through this? Sometimes it's called the classical model of education. It's rooted in ancient Greek philosophy, but it particularly came to prominence when universities began springing up in Europe during the Middle Ages, and particularly during the Renaissance. Trivium model, trivium comes from the idea that there's three stages to education. They would say the first stage of education they called the grammar stage. It's why so many grade schools, I don't think many anymore, but used to be called grammar school. Because they were based on the trivia model of education. Grammar is this. It says we're going to teach the tools of learning. So you'll learn your ABCs. So when it's time to read, you have the tools to read. We're going to get you to memorize your math tables so that when it's time to comprehend calculus, you've already got the basic tools down to do it. We're going to teach you in art perspective and how to mix color so that when it's time to paint, you have the basic tools to execute what you'd like to do. That's grammar school. Okay, so again, this has four. A couple of thousand years in the West, this was the primary approach to education. During what we would consider grade school years, we're going to teach them grammar because a kid can learn Spanish at a stunning level when he's 8 compared to when he's 58. It's like it is a world apart. Second stage of the trivium is known as the dialectic stage. Dialectic just means dialogue or debate. And literally, all the way back, Greek philosophers said, take what we would call a junior high age kid, and they say, that you don't have to, they're already there, developmentally. They want to argue everything. Why? Why do we need to do that? Why is that important? Who cares about that? Why is that of any significance? So they say, from the grammar school, you move to the dialect. Here you learn the tools of learning, the basics. Here you begin to go, why do we need to know this? Of what value is this? The third stage they would call the rhetorical or the logical stage of education, where they go, now you got to figure out how to apply it. Here you got to learn the tools. Here you start figuring out the why. By here, it's like, okay, you kind of know why you need to understand numbers. Now you got to figure out how to do your budget. Now you got to figure out how to run your business. Now you got to, as an engineer, figure out how to calculate the angle. So this is about applying knowledge. This would be roughly similar to what we would call high school. Interestingly enough, we've kind of reversed this. In the 19th century, I don't want to lay it all at their feet, but many do. Two educational thinkers, Horace Mann and John Dewey. Dewey's where we got the Dewey Decimal System and libraries. They said, let's get rid of the trivium. We think that's a bad model. Let's stop talking about these three stages of learning. And instead, they moved to a very different approach. And that approach basically said, let's not teach kids how to mix color or perspective in art. Let's give them a piece of paper and a box of crayons and say, draw whatever you want. Draw whatever you want. Now, I learned this, my little example, when I was in eighth grade. I was a really good guitar player. I had an older brother that's a prodigy, so I kind of quit. I'm like, I haven't gotten better since eighth grade. I'm worse now than I would have been in eighth grade. But at the time, I was pretty good, particularly for an eighth grader, so I was teaching teaching guitar lessons to older people. Okay, this is back in the 70s. So every person that came in, I would go, okay, well, we need to learn some scales. You need to learn some basic music theory. You need to learn how to tune your guitar. You need to learn some basic tools, the grammar. And instead, everyone would say to me, yeah, I don't want to do any of that. Can you teach me the solo from Stairway to Heaven? Everyone. I'm like, number one, no, I can't. And number two, even if I could, you couldn't learn it. You don't have the tools to execute that. It would take you years and years to do that, and that's all you'd be able to do. That, to me, was a great example of going, let's skip the grammar stage. This is Western education has shifted to this model. Let's skip the grammar. Let's cut straight to it. We'll have kids draw their little crayon picture, and we'll even put it on the refrigerator and tell them how fantastic it is. Even though they haven't developed the tools of learning yet. We'll go ahead and skip that stage for the goal, Mann and Dewey said, to boost their self-esteem. They'll feel so much better about themselves if we tell them their drawing is great. Now, I had another practical example of this. One of your students was from China, so he knew the year. I think it was 1997. I was in China, and I was coaching high school kids to play basketball. We had an underground seminary friend that was leading underground seminaries in southwest China to send people into Tibet. And we said, how do we help? And he said, well, you can't except if you want to come help us above ground. I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, the prefect in this area, he will shut down the house churches we're planning. He'll shut down the seminary because he has total authority. He's like the sheriff in the Wild West. But if you'll come over and help me make him look good, he'll look the other way when we plant churches. Go, okay, so how do we make him look good? He go, well, we're getting ready for the Olympics. China's going to host the Olympics, so this is a big deal. He's been told he needs to get his region, southwest China, kind of up to snuff on Olympic fever. So if you'll bring some high school basketball teams over, we'll do a pre-Olympic festival, and you'll go play all these high school teams in southwest China. Like, okay. So we brought some ringer kids over. And one of the things I learned in China was they will kill us at absolutely everything, except we're slightly ahead in basketball for a while, for a while. Here's how I know this. Our first game we played in Chengdu, China, southwest China, and we had a decent team, but this was supposed to be their powerhouse high school team of this region of China. And we're killing them at halftime. And they fire the coach at halftime. So I'm feeling like, oh, we've been culturally inappropriate. So I go to the guy that's leading. I go, should we back off? He goes, oh, don't do that. I go, why? He goes, you want to do the opposite. You want to beat them by more in the second half. Otherwise, that coach will never coach again. Okay, now we're at a nurse. I'm telling my kids, okay, run up the score. They're like, what? You want us to run up the score? Afterwards, the Chinese basketball players came over after the game. Instead of the congratulatory line that we do in America, they came over, picked up our kids' gear, and for the next 24 hours, they acted as personal valets to our students. So we're going like, you don't need to, you guys, it's cool, you don't need to do this or anything. Their assistant coach, who's now the head coach, comes over to me and says, no, you don't understand. They have been vanquished by you. I got, great word. My high school students are going like, what is this? They have been vanquished by you, so now they must learn from you. We're going, okay, that's kind of creepy here. But our kids were like, this is awesome. Hey, can you go get me some stuff over here? He was like, okay. But I realized we have a culture that operates by teaching grammar first. The result is in the early stage, Western education goes much faster. You want to learn to play guitar? Just go listen to stuff you like and try and imitate it. You'll go much faster. And then you'll hit a ceiling because you don't have the tools of learning. Same thing. So we're going to all these high schools, and they would roll out all these Chinese high school students who would do music or art or stuff in front of us. Just total virtuosos. We'd just be like, wow. I remember talking to a principal in schools. I go, so this is like the art school of Chengdu. He goes, oh, no. We're number 147 in this region in art. I'm like, what? We saw that every high school. They actually, like we know, you know, what are we ranked in state? They knew in math, we are number 793 school in South. And I'm like, uh-oh, we're in big trouble. Let me show you a piece from that. This was an eighth grader's drawing in China. I'd like to say, oh, yeah, we saw one of these. No, we saw thousands of these. This is an American eighth grader drawing. Now, I think that's probably pushing it a bit, don't you? We probably have a little better artist than that, I'm guessing. But here's the embarrassing part. They would trot out all these virtuosos, musicians, artists, etc., show us their stuff. And then at the end, every time we were with a high school, we're doing training with teachers, they would say, now we would like the American students to show us some of their work. And we're like, oh my gosh. Well, we just played basketball. That's what we do. So guess what? It was my most embarrassing moment culturally ever. Our students decide, okay, yeah, we've got something. I go, okay, good, good. They did one of the worst renditions I've ever heard of singing the theme song from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And even worse, the Chinese loved it. They're like, this was fantastic. Like, let's go ahead and go home now. But it really drove home to me this idea. What happens when you skip the grammar and try and get people to do advanced stuff? They don't have the tools. They hit that ceiling. All right, all this is a long introduction to the concept I want to talk about in ministry, because I believe that oftentimes we train people in ministry in advanced apologetics, ability to think intellectually about things, to debate, etc. Great things to do, but not if we skip the grammar of ministry, teaching them how to love the outsider. This is the fundamental skill of ministry. This is why Jesus says, here's how the world will know you're my disciples. By what? Really love one another. This is how they'll know. Oh, these are gifted people. They've figured out this. They're different than the world, which is xenophobic. Even though, do you know David Kinneman, a researcher that looks at church in America, and he asked unchurched people about them, you know what they said? Most bigoted, xenophobic people in our culture are in churches. That's their perception. Oh, you're the people that hate lots of folks who are not like you. You hate homosexuals. It's like, well, I don't know if that's true. It doesn't matter. The point is Jesus says we ought to be known for the opposite. Our ability to love the outsider, philoxenia, to entertain the stranger, to pull them in, to include them in what we're doing, and show them love that's not dependent on them being like us, but quite the opposite, the ability to love enemies there. Another example of this. Anybody read any of Malcolm Gladwell's stuff? Gladwell, Tipping Point, I think, was his most famous book. Great book. All of his stuff's really good. He's kind of a researcher, a thinker. Wrote a book called Outliers, which is a research on people who are curve breakers, like Bill Gates or Tiger Woods, LeBron James, the Beatles. People whose performance is way beyond the curve. Okay, so you've taken classes where you go like, it's on a curve and you've got like one idiot who's a total curve breaker. So the rest of you got C's and below because they were like so off the scale. He said, what creates an outlier? Very similar to the same trivium concept I'm discussing here. Here's how he puts it. He says in his research, he found a magic number. Outliers, he would say, are people who've spent 10,000 or more hours disciplining themselves to learn the grammar of their field before their opportunity comes. So he tells some stories. He tells about Bill Gates. He says, Bill Gates, as a high school kid, was in the chess club, go figure, and the university that was near them asked for high school kids who would help do lockup at night. And so they gave him the keys to lock up late at night for the only supercomputer on the western half of America. So you know what Bill Gates did as a kid? He'd sneak in about 10 o'clock every night, unlock, practice programming on a supercomputer. Log 10,000 hours is what Gladwell says. He says when Microsoft and all that stuff started coming down the pike, he's like, Bill Gates was so far ahead of everyone else. He had developed the tools of learning that when they had ideas, he could execute at a level that all those around him couldn't even get close to. Same thing, he talks about the Beatles. He says, why were the Beatles such a phenomenon? Why were they so far ahead of everybody else? He says, well, there's actually a pretty simple explanation. They were desperate for money and they weren't very good. They had a buddy who owned a stripper bar in Hamburg, Germany, who said, I'll let you guys come over. You got to play 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, and you can't repeat your material. So by the time they came back, when they did what we call the British invasion of America, Gladwell would say they were way beyond the 10,000 hours. So the number of songs they had written, for instance, they're like, oh, they had thousands of songs. So they picked the three or four that they thought were really good. They were so far ahead of everyone else. He's like, almost all outliers get this 10,000-hour concept, or what I called earlier, they learn the grammar of their discipline. So this grammar of ministry, philoxenia, if I'm correct in that, I want you to see, and I think I've got this on a slide here. Is that on your handout, this little chart? Okay, I want you to kind of like, I know you can't exactly circle up, sorry to make you do this, but turn around with a couple other people, and I want you to just read the top verse from those four categories. Later on, I'd like you to go back and read all of these. We just don't have time. But I want you to just notice how Jesus treats the stranger and the outsider. Poor, the beggars, women, widows, disease, socio-political outcasts. So just read a couple of those and see if you got any observations there. Yeah, do we have any more handouts? Here, I can give you mine here. Oh, there's an extra. Oh, he got it. Anybody else need a handout? What time are we supposed to be done? 3 o'clock? 3:50. You guys get it done? So you got a couple of them done? Okay, let's get. I know we didn't give you enough time here, but anybody had observations? What'd you notice in some of these passages here?
When he said how the disciples didn't really want to deal with these people,
right?
In a couple stories, you know, they're like
often shooing them.
Away.
Yeah, children. Let's get. Yeah, good.
So in contrast, Jesus actually interacted with each of them at some degree.
Yeah. Often at a deep degree, like the Samaritan woman at the well. I mean, he takes her really seriously. Anything else jumped out? Yeah.
The power of God didn't seem in a high security.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like
yeah, often he used parables to teach them concepts about reaching to the outsider. Very common aspect of Jesus' parables. In fact, Jeremias, I think, says a third of his parables have to do with reaching the outsider. Yeah?
Jesus would definitely like choose like the poor beggars because they would repent their sins and it would be they would want forgiveness while others like the Pharisees, like they just think so highly of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is important. You hear what he's saying? That Jesus almost teaches them like there's a higher receptivity among the outsider. I found that to be true. The first thing I ever learned about ministry, I was doing junior high ministry. I'd just become a Christian. The guy that led me to the Lord, I asked him, made the mistake of asking him, Bob, how do you know who the leaders are? He said, all right, come with me. So, okay. So we stand against the back wall. There's 200, 250 junior high kids. After the meeting, he says, all right, now look around and tell me who the outsiders are. They were so obvious when you're looking. I'm like, okay, there's a kid standing alone. There's two kids. Okay, there. It was obvious. He goes, now you stand here and you watch. Those who go after them and go get them, those are your leaders. No matter how much they know, the real leader's there. So then Bob began, after this, I go, yeah, Bob, man, I totally saw that. So he says to me, never said a harsh thing to me hardly, but he turned to me and he says, okay, here's the deal. If I ever catch you at a junior high meeting talking to your friends instead of pursuing the outsiders, you're not a leader. Like, okay, Bob. But this concept of there's a receptivity in the outsider that's far higher than the people who view themselves as insider in the culture. Some back there are going to say something? Okay, I hope. Okay, anybody else, other observations? Okay, well, you get the point. Please, if you get a chance, read. Yeah?
One observation in that. Luke 16, he actually had named one of the people in his parable.
Yeah. Yeah, he's specific, even. Think about how often that's true. Jesus gets guys like Zacchaeus. Talk about an outsider. He's a tax collector, outsider. He's an irreligious Jew, viewed as a turncoat to his country, and he's a shrimp. Jesus goes, hey, Zacchaeus, I need to come to lunch at your house today. Zacchaeus is so responsive. Says they open the meal up, and before Jesus even has any opportunity to confirm, he's like, I'm giving half everything I own to the poor, I'm repenting. And Jesus is just laughing. He's like, okay, outsiders, when you choose to try and include them, when you show them fellow Exenia, his disciples watched and they went, wow, that was easy. I have a campus friend who works with international students. He goes, you know who the easiest people to reach on any campus are? Internationals. Because they're the people that feel most like outsiders. Most like outsiders. So anybody that makes this effort to demonstrate philoxenia, they're wowed by it. They're like, wow, you want me to come to your house? Wow, I'm so honored. Okay, same thing's true of Paul. Not only did Jesus model and teach about this concept of reaching the outsider and loving your enemies, Paul does the same thing. I know you may not necessarily think of that. Think about 1 Corinthians 13. I think I might even have a slide of it there. Paul talks about, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I don't have love, if I don't get this loving the outside, if I don't understand this concept, doesn't matter if I've got advanced charismatic skills. If I'm a great communicator, but I can't figure out how to love these people into the kingdom, noisy gong, worthless. Paul lives this out. Think about the book of Acts. What is the storyline there? Paul continues to press outward. Outward. They want to huddle in Jerusalem. Paul's like, no. Goes to Antioch first. Well, Antioch's pretty close. It's similar. He goes to the Jewish community. They reject him because they're not that receptive. Guess who is receptive? Gentiles in droves. So Paul makes it a pattern throughout the book of Acts. Jew first. I go to the synagogue. I try and reach the insiders. They kick me out, ban me from the city. I stand on the edge of the city and preach to crowds of Gentiles who respond. Think about it. Later in Acts, he goes, okay, I know we're reaching Asia Minor, what we'd call Turkey today, but Paul's like, I had a vision last night of this European Macedonian guy. Wait, come on over, Paul. We're outside. We need you. You know what the church says to Paul? Oh, no. Those are pagans. We'll go to them. Paul, they'll kill you. He's like, I know. I'm going. So he goes across the ocean and begins to reach the outside. What's Paul saying at the end of his life in the book of Acts? I'm praying I get the opportunity to go to Spain. It's like, now, in a day of travel, that doesn't seem a big deal. Do you know how long it would take somebody to walk from Jerusalem to Spain? You're talking a year. Paul's like, that's my goal. I'm going to the furthest out place. Same thing we see with the early apostles. The records we have of the apostles' death, do you know where their deaths are? All over the place, yeah. The craziest one is that Thomas is martyred in southern India. Certainly not even part of the Roman Empire. I have an Indian student, Shabu, who grew up, he came to America when he was grade school age. He grew up, we were doing an exercise with some students I work with, and I go like, okay, so the church you grew up with, you know, they got the stupid paintings of the pastor, back to the founding pastor. Who's got the oldest founding pastor? This is the game we're playing. So all my students are talking, oh, yeah, it was founded in 1800. And so we get to Shabu, and he goes, Thomas? I'm like, do you have a last name? He's like, just Thomas, the Apostle Thomas. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, we have portraits of the pastors of our church growing up, all the way back to Thomas the Apostle. And we're like, anybody beat that? Got anybody with Peter here? He was like, okay, we're not even close. The point is, the church burst out of its ethnocentrism early on and figured out, okay, Jesus calls us to this Philoxenia. We've got to go figure out how to reach the outsider. I have found over the years in a ministry, I can almost tell the effectiveness of that ministry based on kind of I can almost tell it immediately. What's the level of Philoxenia here? In house churches in Kansas City in the Midwest, I can pretty much walk into it one time. I'm not right all the time, but you can almost tell immediately, okay, this place has this, they've learned this skill. You can also go into other churches, other ministries, house churches, and you can go like, okay, they have really strong Bible teaching, but they don't have the grammar down. They don't have this concept down. I would suggest, you know, a lot of the talk in this conference has been about, you know, how do we evangelize? If your people have not learned the grammar of ministry, how to love the outsider, they will not do it naturally. Very few will. If you're not intentionally teaching this, showing Jesus' example, showing the apostles' example, they will not do it naturally. They just won't do it. And your evangelistic temperature will plummet quickly. Quickly. I mean, you can kind of see this. In fact, there's even a church growth consultant named Wynn Arn. He's trying to measure this. He calls it a love quotient. Isn't that very 60s? The love quotient of this church. He goes, when we want to figure out why a church is growing or not growing, we could look at parking lot. So we got a million things. But there's one thing statistically that dominates. When we ask outsiders, did you feel loved and included? He calls that the love quotient. He goes, it is like ironclad. determine it. We can tell, yep, here's what's going to happen here. Go ask the outsiders. Go ask the outsiders. David Kinnaman's a researcher, kind of probably one of the most prolific younger researchers on the church in America today, and he wrote a book called You Lost Me. Great book. Anybody read You Lost Me? Superb book. You'll love it. If you want to understand lost people in our culture today, it's basically saying people who had an exposure, their parents, but they've walked away. So he goes and interviews them. And here's the basic thing. There's a lot in there, but the basic point is like they did not experience inclusive love. They felt excluded. And so they took off. You lost me. David Kinnaman, K-I-N-N, and it's pretty easy to find, David Kinnaman. Chester and Timmis are two guys that write about church, new churches in America today, and they talk about how so often we evaluate, oh, you need to go find a good church. We'll look at their theological statement. We'll look at their teaching. We'll look at their programs for youth or kids or whatever. He's like, none of those are bad. He's like, but if you really want to know a good church, go figure out whether they've got this down or not. In fact, they say they will ask their leaders, in order to get this, they say, we make them go to a Friday night bar, hardcore bar, and we say, you have to sit at the bar for 4 hours and not get up. So that you can begin to experience that sense of alienation. Oh, I'm an outsider. You won't get the lingo. You won't get, even if you go there every once in a while, you'll be like, I am like a duck out of water here. You have to understand that feeling if you're going to be effective in ministry at reaching outsiders. And I think he's absolutely right. All right, well, let's go on. Here's one last theoretical thing before we shift to practical. Ephesians chapter 2. The Apostle Paul says, here's why we do this. Here's why we're called to show philoxenia. It's rooted. That's an imperative. You should love the outsider. But here's the indicative. Here's why. Here's what he says. Remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated, xenos, from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility. He has obliterated that wall that causes people to have that brotherhood bigotry paradox. Us and them. He's like, oh no, you were once on the wrong side of that wall with God. You were a stranger and an alien. You were an outsider to the kingdom of God. And through the precious blood of Jesus, he blew a hole through that wall, making us one in Christ. This is why we do this. Because I go, oh yeah, I was once an alien stranger to God. And he took the initiative to come after me. Therefore, it's my job. In the context of the basic grammar of ministry is to learn how I do the same. How I obliterate those walls and go after people. Okay, well, let's get practical now. I'm going to use something. Actually, I stole the concept. I originally heard it up here from Gary DeLashman. I think, is it Spiritual Relationships That Last? Is that the name of the book? Yeah. So he wasn't talking so much. He was talking about how you develop intimacy in relationships. And I was thinking about that on the way home, and I was thinking, well, you know, it's interesting when we teach somebody, here's how you be married, because they're not going to learn this naturally. They got to learn these things. They're not just going to do it. And I go, well, the same thing's true in the context of ministry. We have to teach people how to love the outsider. They don't know it naturally. So I kind of rearranged some of his thoughts that I'm stealing here into my own little acronym, PDA, because I think these are the three skills. If you want to teach the people in your house, church, your ministry, how to do this philoxenia, this is what we ought to be holding our leaders accountable to. Okay? I'm not saying we shouldn't tell them you got to learn apologetics. I go, yeah, you need to learn that too. But this is the baseline. They learn apologetics and they don't get this. they'll probably have very little fruit. Okay, number one, pursue. The essence of romance is pursuit. I'll never forget as a young married guy when I learned that. The guy teaching it said, hey, you heard the old joke about the guy whose wife says, you never show me any affection. You never tell me you love me. He says, I told you I loved you when we got married, and if I changed my mind, I'd let you know. So many people are going, romance is not about flowers or a movie. It's about pursuit. That's why women love the dating stage, because the guy gets it. He's like, oh, I must pursue and win you. I must woo you. Woo. Good word. You have to teach your leaders how to woo people, outsiders. They will not do it naturally. I know I've never been particularly good at this. My wife and I have been married over 30 years. She's amazing, but I'm probably not very good at telling her that often. So the stereotype of women going, do you think my hair looks nice? And I'm like, oh, yeah. It's like not that fulfilling. She's hoping I would see it and say something. Or do you love me? It's like, yes, I do. It's like not so fulfilling. The issue is pursuit. Now, here's the crazy thing. A lot of women, after they get married, they go, I know what pursuit looks like in this guy because he pursued me like crazy during the dating deal. Now he got me, bagged me, it's over. I don't see any more pursuit, no romance. Same thing is true for outsiders in ministry. They want to be pursued. You have to teach people this concept of you got to go pursue them. Again, I mentioned the guy that led me to Christ. When I was in high school, I was doing theater stuff, so I'm doing like Oedipus Rex and The Taming of the Shrew and stuff. This guy was a total wrestler jock guy. I knew he hated all this stuff. He'd come and pursue me. Every night I'd look up and there's Bob standing in the corner struggling through another Shakespearean show. Well, at some point I went, okay, this guy's like really pursuing me more than anyone I've known. I'm like, okay, I probably need to be interested in what he has to say. Elmer Towns, a church consultant, puts it this way. He says, we have developed what we call the seven-touch rule. For a person that visits a new church, Towns says, if more than seven people, instead there may be a phone call, a text, all kinds of ways you can do it. If there aren't seven contacts, seven touches, the chance of those people being around a month later is under 10%. On the other hand, when there's more than seven touches, it goes well over 80% chance. He's like, you'd think at some point we go, okay, so this pursuit thing, we got to get this. If we don't get this, and we go, well, we put on a great show. It's like, no, they're looking for someone who will pursue them. So this is the key skill that we have to teach our people to do. One of the things, if you're in a house church and you do a cell meeting, one of the things you ought to be doing, I heard Dennis just talk about it with some of our students here, it's like you got to ask your leaders, okay, so-and-so's an outsider and they showed up last week, who's pursuing them? Can't be the person that brought them only. You'll not be effective. There has to be this sense of, wow, a lot of people are pursuing me. Okay? Now, can that be too much? I had somebody ask me yesterday about this. Can you do too much? I go, yeah, we have a ways to go before we get there. Every once in a while, you'll get that person, maybe a salesperson who knows how to be obnoxious, and they call a person every 5 minutes. You got to calm them down a little bit. There are not that many of those. Most of us do the opposite. We go, oh, not my job to pursue. That's the paid guy's job. In an effective outreach community, you teach pursuit and you hold people accountable. You don't ask just, are we praying for that person? We're saying, who's going after that person? Who's pursuing that person? And you get answers. Because when you do that, a lot of times it's crickets. Everybody's like, oh, I meant to. Then you go like, guys, we're not going to be effective at reaching outsiders unless there's a heavy dose of pursuit. Okay, the second one is draw out. draw out, I think, is also a skill we have to teach people. And that is the skill of saying, instead of me telling the outsider, let me tell you about me and my church and my group and my friends and my accomplishments, we have to learn the skill to become other-centered. And it literally is a skill. You got to go, oh, yeah, I got to put the spotlight on them, not on me. Insider jokes and stuff, it's like, no, got to turn it around. Again, Bob, the guy that led me to the Lord, I've learned about ministry from Bob. I go out to college down in Texas, and Bob comes down to visit me. At the time, I had a roommate from Georgia, a super introverted guy named Inman Fairchild. We just called him the Enema for short. I don't know whether he liked it or not. That's how we treat outsiders. So Bob comes down, and I'm thinking, oh, this is cool. Bob's going to come down. He's going to talk to me. He's going to hang out with me. He's going to talk about me. He didn't. Bob, like a laser, focused on who the most outside person in the room was and focused his attention and everybody else. I can remember, I was very frustrated at the time. I'm a kid. And Bob's like, oh, did you hear Inman's thinking about becoming a plumber? Inman, tell him that story you just told me. Like the most boring story ever told. Bob just laughing furiously. I'm like, you came to see me. What are you doing? I was very frustrated with him. So I ask him about it. Before he goes back to Kansas City, I go, Bob, I thought we were going to spend time together. He's like, look, we have all of eternity to hang out. You've been telling me you've been praying for Inman for a while, and I could just see nobody's going after this guy. So you're just going to have to suck it up. I'm like, okay, Bob. A couple of weeks later, they don't always end this way, I promise you, but a couple of weeks later, we're in bunk beds in our dorm room, and Inman's on the top bunk, clicks his little light on up there. He goes, hey, can I ask you a question? I'm like, yeah. He goes, would you read the Bible out loud with me? I've never read it. I'm like, yeah. Yes, I will. But I sat there thinking all night. I go, you know what happened? Somebody pursued this guy, and then they began to draw him out, ask questions about him, find out his wounds, his hurts, his victories, his personality. And it was like a flower. He started opening up spiritually. Inman became a follower of Jesus. I look at that and I go, I was just there. It was like picking potatoes up or something. Bob planted the seeds. He pursued him and he drew him out. Same thing. You can look in your house church or whatever circle of ministry, you can look around and go, are people drawing the outsiders? Do they have this skill to get the focus off themselves and start asking questions and saying, my kids, when they were young, I had a couple of leaders in youth ministry stuff that were really good at this. My boys, when they were little, I can remember my oldest Scotty used to ask me, he said, hey, Dad, do Darren and Mike, do they like, when they get together with me, do they like have a book that they ask all these questions out of? I thought, you know what? We actually do need to teach people. You need to come low. You need to have some questions to know how to draw another person out, or you won't be effective at this. Okay, now hopefully it's not going to be like, hold on, my next card? Where were you? But it's really more an attitude of, okay, this is not about me. This is about, they're the one who feels like an outsider. If you were hanging out at that bar for 4 hours, isn't that what you'd want? Somebody to come up and ask you some questions about yourself. You go like, man, that'd be like, oh, thank goodness you're here. I was feeling really weird. Okay. The third thing here is affirm. And this maybe is the hardest of the three. To teach somebody not only to go pursue folks, to draw them out, ask them other-centered questions about themselves and their world, their opinions. The last one is the ability to go circle back and say, thank you for sharing that. That really meant a lot to me that you told me about your parents. Okay, in healthy ministries, this concept of encouragement and affirmation is really high. Again, I mentioned I became a Christian in high school. The guy that led me to the Lord, Bob, had just read a little book called The Master Plan of Evangelism. It's a Bible study on Jesus' methods. Well, Bob is so simple and so literal, he just went, okay, God, help me find at this high school 12 guys who don't know you, and I'm going to give the next 30 years of my life to them. It's like, whoa, I was number 10. I knew about 9 of the guys in there, all completely from unchurched backgrounds. All of them, over a period of about 18 months, became followers of Jesus. I will never forget the day when I knew, I raised my hand, I don't know how many times, the day I knew, okay, I think I'm a Christian now, was because Bob would make, he lived in their kind of ministry house, had a flat roof, and he made all of us, in high school, get up on the roof, hold hands, and he'd send one of us into the middle, and he called it, I think I even have, love bombardment. He'd basically make all of us, he'd go around and he'd go, okay, now you say something you like or respect about them. Like, what? Oh my gosh, this is ridiculous, Bob. Here's what I noticed. The amazing thing is, all this stuff started getting spoken that was true. It wasn't made up stuff. It's just an unexpressed stuff. And the guy in the middle, even though we were like high school buddies, the guy in the middle was like, really? I didn't know you thought that of me. I didn't know you saw that in me. And I was like, wow, this little bombardment thing, this is incredible. I've done it with a group of strangers before, and you know what's amazing? First of all, people can, even on a first impression, they can say, hey, I really like this about you. Second thing I've noticed is, even though the person knows, none of you actually even knows me, they still are like, ooh. It just totally fills them up. That sense of, wow. In a cynical world, encouragement is like kryptonite. I mean, it's just unbelievable for outsiders. They are so used to the opposite that when they get in an environment of people that pursue them, draw them out, and then begin encouraging or affirming them, it's really a powerful, powerful thing. Okay, I don't think, we got about 5 minutes left. I want to leave a little time for questions. Anybody have any thoughts about this? Yeah?
Would you consider PDA to be like the trivium of building good relationships?
To some degree, I do think that learning pursuits a lot easier than learning to draw out. And affirming is really hard for a lot of our people to learn, for me to learn.
So if you follow like the same pattern.
Yeah, I think when I'm working with a young leader, the first thing I want to teach them is go after the outsider. And then as they move forward, I want to go, now when you go after them, you got to start learning to draw them out. So I do think it's a little sequential. Yeah. 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 Yep. Yeah, man, we have run into this so much. I have failed at this a lot because you'll get a lot of extra grace required people and they will overwhelm the group. So my basic deal is, guys, you cannot take on people who have some special, unique needs unless your core is very strong. Don't underestimate the resources it takes and the time. We had a group of mentally retarded young guys that were at a coffee shop. We were doing stuff, and they just came in droves. They were so excited that somebody was interested in them. And they were absolutely loved by the community, but they destroyed a couple of house churches because we didn't have a strong enough core to be able to be effective with them. So I think now we're trying to coach people to go, hey, keep that in balance. That might be a good time to multiply. So we took one of our leaders who had a heart for these guys particularly and said, why don't you start one for them and their friends? It was far more effective. Yeah?
I really like what you had to say about the pursuit in the PDA.
Yeah.
I know in our Bible study that we have with our some of my roommates, we got a challenge one time because we were being really passive with people and waiting on people, and we get a challenge looking at the Great Commission, how he calls the disciples to go out and make disciples. And,
yeah.
It's not waiting for the nations around them, but going out and doing it. And I think that's a really really a crucial part of evangelism.
Great point. Well, that's, again, notice Jesus says the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. He didn't wait passively. Peter says on the Mount of Transfigurations, oh, this is awesome. Moses, Elijah, Jesus, let's build three churches here and everyone can come to us. It's like, no, no, no. So the Great Commission is not come and hear, it's go and tell. Go and tell. Yeah. Yeah.
Why would Jesus give a name in that parable?
Why did he use Lazarus' actual name?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a long question. There's a lot of debate on that. So there's some stuff you can read if you're interested. Come check with me. I know one particular book that has a discussion on that. It would be worth reading. Okay, yeah.
For the PDA, like the pursuit part, like, can you give like a couple examples of like good like pursuit methods?
Yeah, I mean, he's asking, you know, how do you know what healthy pursuit is versus, like, stalking? And I would say that the first rule I would say, which I don't mean to minimize your question, but any pursuit is better than none. But I think the healthy pursuit is when somebody reads the cues socially. Sometimes people are not very good at that, and so they over-pursue when the person's clearly, we would call it they run stop signs. But in general, what I want to do is find out, like, I had a guy at KU, a student up in Lawrence, and I was not picking up the signs. So he finally literally asked me, how come when you come to town, you don't call me up? I'm like, okay, because I was trying not to over-pursue. And so I think it's better to make the mistake of doing your best job at pursuing. But in a cell, in a leadership team, it's really good to have other people tell you things like, hey, dude, back off that person. You're not reading their signals. So I do think that we do have to coach leaders to read whether a person's saying more, come on, or hey, thanks, but no thanks. That's hard. And some people in their families learned that, and some people didn't. It's okay if they didn't. We need to coach them. I mean, the Philadelphia part, I do think there's a natural orientation to love one another there, but I also believe that you have to prime that pump, so to speak. So even something as simple as love bombardment, I can tell you that the level of community in my high school group after we did that just jumped up because the leader primed the pump. He tried to make sure that we encouraged one another. If somebody was doing something, he'd say, hey, Eddie's playing baseball on Thursday. We're all going to be there to support him. So he taught us and modeled for us what pursuit looked like. So the principles are the same, but I don't think it's as hard to teach how to love one another. We're kind of already hardwired for that. Having said that, we're still not that good at it. Is that what you were asking, though? Did you have an observation on that?
Well, it's like, you know, for example, in general, if there's like a group of people that don't know how to love like strangers that well, I mean, what can be the best way to like sort of show them how to love strangers?
Well, honestly, I think very similar to teaching them apologetics, oftentimes the leader has to teach these things to them. They need to show them, here's what Jesus did. Here's what the disciples did. So that they see it and they go, oh. So I know for me, Bob taught me very intentionally. I was totally an insider guy, like, oh man, these are the people I think are. And Bob was the one who started teaching me, no, you didn't see those people there. So it was an intentional discipleship process, not something that he left unsaid. Yeah, last question. Yeah, you know, sometimes when you put people in that context, they get it immediately. Of course we have to do this now. So that is great. They can practice in a less difficult context there. So, all right, let me end with a quote here, and then I'll stick around if you got questions. The Catholic priest Pierre Teilhard de Chardin put it this way. Someday, after we've mastered the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we will harness for God the energies of love. And then for a second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire. I believe this is true in ministries. If you can get your people intentionally doing this philoxenia, it's like an atomic weapon. It's powerful. And God can blow the wind of the Holy Spirit into the sails of that ship like he's never done before.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.